All right, so let me put this here. Can y'all still hear? Okay? You can hear? All right.
I can hear.
Dennis can hear. That's good. We're good. Dennis and I have been brainstorming together on this topic of hope and resilience, which I think is also a conversation about change. Change that we want and change that we don't want, change that we ask for and change that is kind of thrust upon us. And we have about 4 pages of typed up notes that we've prepared to share with you today. But I don't think we're going to be reading from those notes too much, so much as just talking with one another and talking with you and asking you to think faithfully and creatively about some of the burning bush moments in your own lives and in the life of the church, either this specific church or other churches that you have been a part of over the course of your life and your faith journey. I do want to start out, though, by talking about hope and resilience, our 2 words which kind of frame the day. We both put some thoughts in the document about what hope means and what resilience means. And so I want to let you start, Dennis. Do you want to tell us kind of what hope means to you?
Sure.
And then we'll go from there.
Well, I'm not a great scholar of theology or philosophy or psychology, but I am a storyteller and I want to appreciate stories of the Bible. So I may be answering some of these with stories.
Good.
Last night, Betsy and I stayed with her niece, who's here in Raleigh. 20 years ago, she gave birth to preemies, twins, they're now 20 years old. But they weighed 1 pound 5 ounce and 1 pound, what, Betsy, 7 ounces. And according to Betsy's niece, the doctor said they'll have about a 10% chance of survival. Well, this weekend, by the way, we just brought Ellie's things back from University of North Carolina at Asheville to leave at home while she was going somewhere else. And the other daughter, the other twin, is in Charlotte. By the way, these are the grandchildren of Kathy Denny.
She's a church member here.
That's Earl's mother.
Yeah.
So I asked Carrie, I said, Carrie, what was it like for you? She said, well, all we could do was hope. We got all this information about how bleak it was, but all we could do and all we had was hope. And that's what helped us go through those 4 months in the neonatal intensive care unit and several years later trying to hope that these children would survive. Some of you may have taught Ellie and Faye at either Magellan or at Sanderson. Brilliant and lovely young women. So I asked Carrie if I could share that story because to me, hope means what's left sometimes when everything else seems to have gone. The other story I remember is when I was a chaplain trainee, a resident chaplain in Winston-Salem, and my supervisor read my verbatim and jumped all over me, and I said, why? He said, you have no reason to take away people's hope. But it was unrealistic, I said. Hope is not logical, is it? It is not logical. But there is something there that beckons us to believe that God has something else. Jeremiah said, you know, I know the plans you have for me, not plans to prosper, not to hurt, but plans for hope and for the future. So to me, again, I like the Spanish word esperar. That means to wait, esperar, but it also means to hope. So those are some of the elements through these little stories that where I feel hope is prevalent in my life and where I find hope.
Mm, thank you. I appreciate your disclaimer, and I share the same one about not being a powerhouse theologian, but I do love the theologians, and so where you go to story, I go to read what other theologians have said about. So last night and throughout the week as I was digging around to see who might have a good word about what hope is, you might have a good definition, I found a good German theologian. Jürgen Moltmann. Who reads Moltmann in your spare time?
Yes, always.
Justin and I were reflecting on a long night spent in the library at Wake Forest with glassy eyes after reading Moltmann for hours and hours and trying to write a paper to turn in to make sense of it. Luckily, there's no paper. But Moltmann does have a really good book called Theology of Hope. And in that book, he talks about basically how humanity lives in the present moment between the past and the future. And in that present moment, Moltmann calls kind of the front lines of the past, which is full of pain and loss and grief built around the human experience, but it's always pushing forward toward the kingdom of God, which is our eschatological, like our future, our eternal life kind of hope that we have. And as we live on those front lines, as Moltmann says, it's our job to actively participate in hope, which pushes us and this world a little bit closer toward what that kingdom looks like. So for Moltmann, hope is very much what's left when everything else is gone. And it's a call to action for us to embody that hope for everyone around us and to continue to shape the world in such a way that it looks a little more like God's kingdom. And I thought that was a really powerful and encouraging definition of hope, especially as we think about the church and some of the questions you raised in the sermon today. We've been hearing for a long time that the church is changing and that the church has to change. But many of us don't want that change because the church tends to be a place where we come to receive comfort, to feel safe. And so when that is starting to change, we feel very unsettled and uncertain. So being reminded that hope still exists in the midst of change is okay. And in fact, it might be how we're living into God's calling for us. We'll get back to that in a minute. But I want to talk about resilience. That's the other word for today. So how would you define that, Dennis?
Well, I got a nice message last night from Becky Sansbury. Becky Black Sansbury has been a friend of Betsy's and mine since we were in seminary together 100 years ago, or whatever that was. And she said, "I'm so sorry I can't be there, but I'm going to be with my mom. I'm her caregiver, primary caregiver. She's 99, or will be 99. Fran is a member here. And but she said, "I'm so sorry." You talk about resilience. Becky Sansbury shares in her book, After the Shock, The Road to Resilience, is probably in the library. And she's probably spoken here. She spoke at First Baptist Church when we were members there too. But I asked her if I could quote her. She says in her book, there are four C's to remember about resilience. She called them comfort. You mentioned comfort, Chrissy. Control, community, and connection. Those are the signs of stability and stickability: comfort, control, community, and connection. And really, I thought of the church because that's really what I like to think that the church has done in my life over my years and what I would like the church to continue to do. But I'm going to add, excuse me, Becky, if you watch this later, I'm going to add two more C's, and that is curiosity and creativity. And that's what I mentioned this morning. I really think the spirit of curiosity and the hope for also the creativity, what God's going to do with us, all these resources, is an exciting place to be in the church. And I think that now, as difficult as it is, it's an exciting place to be church. Did any of you read about, anybody know Benedict Cumberbatch? Do you like him? Is he one of your, he's one of my favorite actors. I just think he's so talented. You know what he's done in this period of time during the Ukrainian crisis? He has opened his home and invited in a family to come and to live with him. And he says he is trying to provide stability for them and some comfort and a respite for them, medical care that they need. And I thought, you know, isn't that what the church is about? Isn't that what the opportunity that we have now in this convoluted culture that we're living in to provide some of that comfort and stability to people who are just outside there searching and wondering. And I know that many of you, or some of us, have been to Bucha, and we've just been hurting so much for those people, our brothers and sisters in that Bucha Baptist Church where we spoke and with whom we worked in the Village of Hope. And we continue to pray for some kind of resilience that will enable them to survive, whether that's within the walls of Ukraine and the borders of Ukraine or here in our own community. And there's so much that we could go off on there and talk about too.
No, that's good. As you're talking, the words from Isaiah, two words, comfort, oh comfort my people. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then behold, I'm doing a new thing. Mm-hmm. And I think we find ourselves kind of in between those two phrases, comfort, yeah, oh comfort, right. And then, you know, behold, I'm doing something mm-hmm. new, which is unsettling in some ways, but exciting.
It is.
It's exciting. It is. One of the definitions of resilience that I found was Dr. Pauline Boss, who writes in her book called The Myth of Closure, that resilience is the ability to be flexible in the face of pressure without breaking down. Mm. The ability to be flexible in the face of pressure without breaking down. It's like the tree that bends, right, as the winds blow all around it, but doesn't break and snap in half when the storm gets strong. That has been a powerful phrase for me and for us as we have navigated the last couple of years together, trying to figure out how to do everything completely differently and then how to snap back and try to pick back up on the things that matter the most. So I want to talk about the church. Actually, I want to have a conversation about the church in general and how we navigate changing times. And I want to do that, if we can, maybe it'll work, maybe it won't, through your stories.
Oh, okay.
Can we do that?
Sure. I love to talk about myself. What would you like to
know? I know. Okay. Y'all can write your questions down. I'm just kidding. I keep thinking about how different church life is now than it was even when I was growing up, which feels longer and longer ago. But when I think about our seminary experiences, yours and mine, they were probably different. And when I go back, I just visited Wake Forest Divinity School last weekend, and it felt like a totally new place. It's been 13 years since I graduated from there. And so time is just passing by, and to me it feels like the church is having a hard time keeping up. And I think that's okay, but I want to name that. Phyllis Tickle, who you also mentioned during the sermon today, provides a framework. When she's a biblical scholar and a scholar of Christianity, when she looks back in all of Christian history, and she says even stretches into Jewish history, every 500 years there's a major change, a major shakeup in Christendom, which is a global practice of Christianity. And she names those moments in her book called The Great Emergence. So you may remember in 2017 when y'all put sticky notes on the walls, which are the doors, which are still in the sanctuary, you were marking the 500th anniversary of the Great Reformation. So you were doing what Martin Luther did when he put the thesis on the wall. And I remember celebrating that, not with you, but in the church I was in, and thinking, wow, we're 500 years into, you know, Protestantism, and wow, isn't it great? But what I failed to realize is that it's time for a major shakeup, and that's not always so great. And it's been interesting to watch kind of as history has unfolded around that. So I did a little homework last night and was thinking, okay, well, what were the markers of that change other than, you know, we get Presbyterians, we get Methodists, and we get Lutherans, Luther, Calvin, Zwingli, we get Baptists eventually. But what caused that? Does anybody remember what some of those issues were? Okay, so we can worship in the Vulgate, which is the language that we normally speak. There was a linguistic challenge. They were debating things about how are we justification by faith or works. We were debating the theology of communion. Really serious things were happening. There was a critique about popes, specifically popes, but also high-up bishops being in cahoots with high-up political leaders and how that didn't feel right, the selling of indulgences, corruption in the church. So, you know, We got language problems.
The access to scriptures.
Access
too.
To scripture. Yeah.
Sola scriptura. Yeah.
So we've got theology problems. We've got language problems. We've got corruption problems. We've got politics and faith.
Sounds a lot like the U.S. government today, doesn't it?
I mean, I wasn't going to say that, but if you want to say it, you can.
It is. Did it occur to you, however, that, of course, Phyllis Tickle died in 2015. Mm-hmm. A lot of things have happened with the church since 2015. Yeah. And I'm sure, of course, Roger's here, Jerry's here, other experts in church growth and all of that. Maybe you have some things to say, not only about emergence Christianity, right. Phyllis Tickle talks about emergence, but there's also the emergent church as well, the emerging church. And a lot of changes have happened, and I think that 500-year period might have been condensed quite a bit in just the last few years, so that we're seeing the changes more rapidly and having to respond in a way that either energizes us or it divides us even more and splits us off, and so we become combative. So. All of these are issues that we are dealing with now. Phyllis Tickle says there will always be denominations, but they won't look like what we have experienced in the past. And we already know that that's so very true. And there will always be churches, but they'll be much different than they are today. So, yeah, I think that we're dealing with a lot of those issues right now, and what Christianity is going to look like. We are a marginal people, we Christians now. We are not used to being marginal. We are marginal in our culture, and that's a big adjustment.
Yeah, you know, I think American Christians are not used to being marginal, but we have a lot to learn from people in the southern and eastern hemispheres who have been in the margins practicing Christianity for a long time.
Yeah. And Harvey Cox, in one of his writings, I think it's The Future Church, one of his later ones, says that the real hope for the church can be found in the third world, specifically in Latin America, where he pinpoints the growth of the Pentecostal church, not because of their Pentecostalism or their expression of worship, but because of their concern for social justice and for meeting the needs of the hungry, the poor, those who have been left out, the truly marginal people. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, you know, that's amazing. You know, it's a good reminder. Yeah. That's our future. That's our future.
It is. And, you know, I love that it very closely mirrors what I see when I go to the Gospels. I see Jesus who goes out looking for the margins and begins the movement from the margins and then brings the margins into the center.
Yeah.
So even though sometimes when we talk about this work in our own lives, it sounds like we're using language from our world, from our culture, or from our social locations, what we're really doing is trying to be like Jesus. We're trying to decentralize our story, go to the margins, and see where God is at work, and then lift that up. Okay, so I promised that we would tell your stories. So the broad context for today, of course, is change and transformation, hope and resilience amidst change and transformation. And Dennis really felt called to the Exodus story, which is a tremendous narrative framework for us from our Bibles of change.
It is.
And transformation.
And I think there was one thing that came clear to me, that not all transition results in transformation.
Oh, that's good. Say more.
And making sure that what we are experiencing is thought about, processed, submitted to prayer, studied. How is it that this transition can be transformative? How can it make something new? How can it open to God's creativity? Okay, I'll say something about my experience.
Yeah.
Roger and I grew up in the wonderful place, and Janice, Caldwell County, Hudson, Cajos Mountain, and Sawmills. Those are the greater metropolitan areas. We thought, at Union Grove Baptist Church when I was a kid, I thought that a Methodist was, just some kind of sinner. We would allow some Pentecostals to come in, but Methodists, Presbyterians, Catholics, forget it. As a student at Appalachian in the Baptist Student Union, we had a revival team. That team went out to different churches to preach and to give testimony and to sing. This is a thing of the 1960s. They don't do that anymore. I know that. But we went to my home church, and one of the members of that BSU team was a black man, a young man, and I don't think he'd ever been in a white church before, and this white church of my childhood, and as far as I do, had never had a black person there, especially a black person who would come and speak from the pulpit and be staying in homes as we did as a revival team. So he gave his testimony, and we sang, and we did all that the revival teams do back in those days. And this one gruff deacon down on the second row, he walked up to me after the service and looked at me in all his gruffness, and he said, "You know, this is the first time we've had a person, a colored person, in our congregation." And then I waited, and he said, "And it's about time." Wow! What made the difference? What made the difference that his mind had changed? He got to know that young man. He met him before and heard his testimony, heard his little devotional that he gave. It made a difference. The experience made a difference for him. In terms of racism, I stood at the bus stop as a 10-year-old. Schools were segregated at that time, and the small black community on the edge of the Catawba River had to drive past several schools, three or four schools, to get to their school on the north side of Lenore. They had to pass right by where I was waiting on a bus to go just a couple miles to Baton School. And there were some boys, older boys, who picked up some rocks and started tossing them at the bus and calling out names, the N-word, at these children who were going to their school. Now, I was caught in a dilemma. They were telling me to pick up the rocks too. And I stood there in silence, I will confess. But Carolyn Kincaid, scrawny 70-pound fourth grader or third grader, put her hands on her hips and she said, "You put down those rocks right now. You know that's the wrong thing to do." And she said, "If you don't, I'll tell Mr. McCurry, the principal. I'll just let him know, and you'll get a spanking." And where did she learn that? Well, she learned that at her church, singing that little song, red and yellow, black and white. She learned those things. The ministry to children and the experience came together to make a difference and to bring about some transformation. That's one of the areas in which I feel my experience has led toward a transformative understanding of race and what that was all about. I'm going to be talking too much. Let's talk about people with disabilities and special needs. And I love what this church has done and is doing in accepting and welcoming people with special needs. The buddy break still goes on. At our table, from time to time, was Paul. Paul was 30 years old. He helped my dad in his little produce business. And Paul would come in and eat. At age 30, he couldn't talk plain. And he was one of my friends. I was about 5, and he was 30. But he was one of my friends. And we'd play together, and he'd make little toys out of wood. And Paul, we called him in those days mentally retarded. He was on the spectrum today, but later on in life, Paul would carry or drag his little trucks and cars with him along the Conley Springs Road, a very busy road. And when we were missionaries in Ecuador, I got this letter from Mom that said, "You know, Paul was hit and killed by a car, dragging his little wooden car behind him." And I wrote a letter to his parents, letting them know how important Paul had been to me and how when I went into teaching for the 2 years I lasted as a teacher, I was in special education, and then later in seminary I had done some ministry with those on the spectrum with mental retardation and other handicaps. And I let them know how transformative that experience with Paul had been. So all these experiences of my childhood helped me to form into the person I thought God was maybe calling me to be and to do. So let me stop there.
Yeah, these are great examples. And I want to, thinking about the stories that you've shared and the transformative experiences you've had around being with people who are different from you, whether it's race or different kinds of abilities, I also want to think about what happens after that kind of Damascus Road burning bush experience. When, you know, you've been living your life and then the intervention comes or the person comes along and you learn the lesson. And then you have to figure out how to live the next few days. Yeah. And then the next couple of months.
Oh, yeah.
And so, and we experienced that as a community, too. Like, I remember we were going along. We had launched a kindness campaign. Anybody remember that? 2020? A 12-month campaign. And then COVID came. Intervention. And everything was different. And the church rallied together to say, we've got to do this differently. Mm-hmm. And I think we had the energy and the adrenaline for about 6 weeks of that. Mm-hmm. But as we know, the season has gone on. So how does one, individually or collectively, summon the courage to continue the journey in the wilderness? So using your Exodus story, Moses, goes back.
Wow, that's a tough one, isn't it? Because I don't feel very, very courageous very often. I did once, but it wore off. back in the mid-90s, you remember the mid-90s? Any of you old enough to remember the mid-90s? Betsy and I were in Virginia. There was a meeting of the Baptist General Association of Virginia in Roanoke, where we were living. I was pastor of a church there. The Baptist General Association has auxiliary meetings, and they have special groups in interest. And one special group wanted to meet. They were the parents of LGBTQIA children. And they wanted to meet for mutual support. At that time, it was just gay and lesbian, parents of gays and lesbians. The BGAV said, no, we don't have a space for you. We hadn't planned on this. So there was a phone call to me as pastor. Your church, Calvary Church there in Roanoke, it's a pretty big church. Do you have any space that we could have a room for parents who are going through the issues and questioning of what it is to be a parent of a lesbian or gay child to meet? I said, well, we have 99 rooms. We're only using 14 of them. Maybe we could come up with a room. And I even checked with the deacon chair. Oh, yeah, we've got plenty. So they were invited to come. The local newspaper picked it up that BGAV denies a place for these families, but Calvary Church is allowing them to come. And their pastor is Dennis Herman. And my phone began to ring. And I had questions like, well, here's where the courage comes in. Well, are you feeding them? I said, well, if they're hungry, maybe, but we're providing a room, but I don't know if we're feeding them. Like, that would make a difference. Then I started getting, not email at the time, I got letters that said, we know what's going on at your church. The pastors there are showing pornographic films in the study. Crazy stuff. I mean, really crazy stuff. And then some of my own members of that church who weren't quite where we were in opening and accepting the parents of these children, our youth, would come and say, well, I don't think we ought to be doing that. That's against what the Bible says. So, yes, there are times when we are asked to back up our actions, our convictions, with the courage to go ahead and do what we know is right. One young man later came to me. He was in his early 20s. He said, I would like to be baptized. I've been in this church all of my life. I said, wonderful. He said, but I'm gay. Oh, I said, do you believe in Jesus? Do you profess Christ? I would ask you the question. I don't ask you the question, are you gay or straight? I ask you the question, do you accept Christ as Savior and Lord? Do you reject evil in your life? Will you follow Jesus and the way of Jesus as best you can? If you can answer those questions, yeah, you can be baptized here. So, those kinds of issues come up. I don't feel courageous. I just feel like it's a question of being faithful and honest sometimes. Yeah. That probably didn't answer anything you asked me.
No, I mean, that's not in the notes, Dennis.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. I'm just kidding. You said my story.
No, it's fine. It's good. I mean, I just have some follow-ups now, which are also not in the
notes. Follow up.
I think it is a good story and a relevant story to the kinds of phone calls and requests that churches and pastors and deacons are still getting. And we're not in the mid-90s anymore.
No.
We're in the mid-2020s, or approaching it. We're in the first quarter of the 2020s.
Yeah.
But the questions are still very similar.
Right.
And so I love what you said. It's not courage. It's acting in faith and doing what I know to be right. But I think that's all synonymous with courage. Mm. And I think that perspective is situated well within Christian history. What does Christian courage look like? It means standing in faith and conviction when everything around you says the opposite.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's a really lonely place to be sometimes,
mm-hmm.
As a pastor or as a church. If you're the first church to open your door, or if you're the first pastor to say, yes, you can come, we'll figure it out if you get hungry. But also, you know, that also is kind of the intervention is the phone call. And you mentioned how sometimes for your church it's hard to wrestle with difference, theological opinion,
exactly.
or conviction about how we are to live life together. So in your experience, have you found ways to retain a sense of comfort for all people who have already called your church home, while still standing in a position of courage and faith and conviction? How do you juggle those things?
Well, we do a lot of juggling. Greystone Church, from the very beginning, had to do a lot of juggling. They're wonderful founders, two of whom are still here today, I think, and that's wonderful. They didn't agree, but together they made covenant with each other. And they were going to stick with each other and allow the disagreements to occur. Well, in my wonderful period of 11 years that I was here, I call that the golden age for me, and it may be in some ways for the church, but perhaps not. We wanted to build our sanctuary, to realize our dream, and so we spent a lot of time on structure, on buildings, and we were together. We were so excited and enthused, and I remember meeting in this room and marching in on Palm Sunday in April 2003, and we had a bagpipe, a woman playing the bagpipes, and one of the children was carrying the cross that's out there on the breezeway, and we were marching behind that, and we marched into the new sanctuary. And it was just a wonderful, exciting, exhilarating experience. But in all that experience of trying to raise the money, keep people here, to make sure that there was what we needed in terms of resources, we had to make sure that we were very careful that everyone and everyone's ideas were welcome and included. It didn't mean we have to do everything that they said, that we trust the congregation to make those decisions. I love what Dewey Hobbs, a saint in Baptist life in North Carolina, said, long gone now, but Dewey always said, we trust the process. We really do. We must trust our process, that God is working through and in spite of the process to bring about God's good will and purpose. From the very beginning, this church said, women will have an equal opportunity to serve, to be part of this congregation. And they didn't say that was just the deacons or just the whatever committee. But they probably at that time envisioned a woman being a pastor of Greystone Church. And again, we have had women pastors, but never a senior pastor before. And that was also a transition, and it will be a transformational transition, I think. Now, spotlight's on you.
I know, I don't know what to say now.
But first.
I think that's a really important legacy for Greystone to embrace. As we think about what our future is together, this church was founded with a mission and a dream, a mission to reach the people of this neighborhood, right?
Yes.
We're a neighborhood church. We were sent out from First Baptist Raleigh and the RBA. Tell me if I'm getting this wrong. to be a mission, to be a faith community for the people of this neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And so we've had to reimagine, what does it mean to be a neighborhood church, given that neighbors are coming and going and our kind of circumference is growing as Raleigh grows. So what does it mean to be a mission and a faith home for all kinds of people who we call neighbors? And then that dream of being a church that was not, in 84, which is when the charter was signed, right? 83 is when y'all mm-hmm. left First Baptist, and then 84, this became its own congregation. Baptists were all, were beating each other up over women in ministry. Oh, no. And this church said, you know, we're not going to beat each other up over that. We're going to support women in ministry. And that took courage. Mm-hmm. And that same kind of courage is still part of our DNA. And so I think it's one of the tools that is in our toolbox as we think about how are we rebuilding, how are we dreaming anew with God, and how are we creating something new with God? What does new life for Greystone look like? And I think that those two pieces of our past, what does it mean to be a church for our neighbors, and what does it mean to be a church with courage for this moment, not just the moment that happened in 83 and 84, no. but what does it mean to be a church with courage in 2022? And then how do we find a place for everybody yeah. as we figure out what that looks like?
And I'll quote that great theologian, Fred Rogers, who said, who are the people in your neighborhood? They're mm-hmm. the people that you meet when you're walking down the street, people mm-hmm. that you meet each day. And what does that look like now? You know, it looks different in Raleigh than Asheville. In Asheville, it's really quite different. But here in this section, you may see a lot of people in retirement communities, yep. but you'll see people internationally here at the Food Line working, helping you with your groceries or wherever. Yeah. And, you know, I think that's to assess. I think it was Becky Sansbury says, the road to resilience for the church, I think, what it means would be EAR, E-A-R, experience, assumptions, and resources. Experience learning from the past. So let's be reflective, as Donald Shun says, reflective practitioners. Let's look at what we do and what we have done. Let's discard some things that are no longer functional and be able to reflect on what is really helpful. When, as a staff, I won't prolong this, but we would all often meet as a staff in the fireside room, and someone would say, well, let's have a church retreat. I said, okay, why? You know, let's look at that. We had a church retreat 5 years ago. It went really well. Why did that go well? Why do we need a church retreat? Is that where we want to spend our resources, our time? And what are some of the assumptions about that church retreat? I think it's important to look at our assumed covenants and our actual covenants. There's some things we might assume. Let's make sure that those assumptions are in line with our actual covenants that we make as a church.
Okay. I thought there was one more.
Well, there is one more. Well, experience, assumptions, and resources, taking stock.
Yeah.
So, you know, I look around this room. What? Look at the great resources we mm-hmm. have. When the 17 founders started out, no place to meet, no land purchase, no physical amenities, not a lot. But they had 17 people who were just eager and charged and ready to go out. So they had the resources of one another and God's Spirit and the feeling and the calling and the being sent by the Association and First Baptist Church to establish this wonderful mission here to this part of the world. And they went door to door. Can you imagine that? Door to door. I mean, I just really talk about courage. But Judd Emmons loved it. He thought that was the most wonderful thing in the world. Carol Lee said she didn't really like it, but she'd go along with it. And, you know, in the very beginning, Carol Lee writes that she was just opposed to this whole idea. But then she began to think about it and process it and pray about it. And she became such an enthusiast about this mission here and stuck with it. Talk about flexibility. Mm. And I could point to each one of those early members and say the very same thing about Doug and Nina and many others who were so resilient and were able to do that. But I look at this building, I look at the resources. What, 11 acres, 10.5, whatever acres of land, and this building, Well, what if you had only 17 members in this big building? What would you do? Well, you do what we were visiting in Sydney, Australia. We saw First Scots Presbyterian Church. We looked out the hotel window, and that was, I said, it looks like a church building down there. And it had Gothic windows, but on top of it was a 10-story apartment building. I said, what are they doing? They built an apartment building on top where they could provide housing to people downtown and where they could provide income for the sustenance of that particular, you know, how creative can you get, you know? There they are, they had resources, and they were able to move to creativity out of that.
Well, I want to tell you thank you, Dennis, for being in conversation with us today, for leading in worship, for offering a bit of comfort, the reminder that God's with us, and a call to be creative and flexible and curious as we move forward. It's 11:59, and all of the child care providers and our volunteers who are teaching our children will fuss at us if we don't wrap this up.
Yeah, we have 2 hours more after you get through. We're
going
to continue.
Yeah, that's right.
Thank you.
But thank you all for being here, and I do want you to do one piece of homework. I want you to think about a moment in your life when something happened and you had to change. Not the kind of change that you sought out and planned for and everything went accordingly. But sometime in your life when something hit you and you had a change, I want you to journal about that and then think about how that's going now, right? Change happens in an instant, but then you have to live with it forever.
Yeah, yeah.
So think about how that's going now. And the second thing I want you to do is pray for the church, for all of us as we try to figure out how to piece it back together and become an in-person church again, that God would give us all a spirit of creativity and curiosity, and that the winds would blow and we would know how to follow the Spirit of God alive here.
Pentecost is coming.
Pentecost is coming. Thank you, Dennis.
Thank you.
Thank you all.